Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The unemployment rate in the United States has hit an 18-year low. The Labor Department said today the jobless rate ticked down to 3.8%, which means a nearly 9-year economic expansion is still on.
But there are questions today around the world about the future of the global economy after the Trump administration slapped tariffs on steel and aluminum from allies, Europe, Mexico, and Canada, all of which promised to retaliate with tariffs of their own, some specifically targeting parts of the U.S. that supported President Trump. In a statement today, French President Emmanuel Macron said he told Trump in a phone call that the U.S. tariffs were a mistake and that economic nationalism could lead to war, as it did in the 1930s. Let's convene our Friday Politics Roundtable. This week we have Juana Summers, senior writer at CNN Politics. Hi, Juana.
Hey, guys.
And Brian Bennett, senior White House correspondent for Time Magazine. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good to be with you.
And let's start with some of the numbers. We'll talk more about the jobs numbers, but the Dow fell yesterday after President Trump imposed these tariffs on steel and aluminum on the U.S.'s three biggest trading partners, Canada, Mexico, the European Union. And they have said they're going to retaliate with pork tariffs, Harley-Davidson, Kentucky whiskey, things that come from areas that supported the president. Even people like his fellow Republican Paul Ryan, whose state, Wisconsin, is being targeted with those tariffs, are not happy. Why did he do this? Brian, you take it.
All right. So I really – our president is transactional. I mean, he doesn't want tariffs for tariffs' sake. He wants tariffs for negotiating leverage. He's trying to get some concessions out of Mexico and Canada and the NAFTA deal, for example. And so he's slapped these tariffs on. He wants more negotiating leverage with China, for example, as well. And you know, he's making that play, and we'll have to see what kind of, he's also gambling that the economy right now is strong enough and that this impacts a small enough percentage of the economy that it won't have too big a drag.
Juana, it was remarkable to hear the French president bring up this idea that economic nationalism could lead to war. I mean, even just to use a word like that is worth noting. But, you know, what about that damage to our relationships with key allies around the world? Is that a real concern?
Absolutely. We heard a strong response from those allies. And keeping this in context, you know, this move follows months of uncertainty. The Trump administration has been dangling potential exemptions for allies in front of them in returns for different concessions. But with moving forward on these tariffs, at least in my view, the administration now faces a really big test of whether or not this aggressive strategy will actually work and they'll be able to get promises from its trading partners, or whether or not this could actually backfire on the United States economy. And that's really the signals we're seeing from allies right now. They're not saying they're not pleased, I think, would be an understatement.
Well, but to staying with the economy, does the president get cover with the jobs numbers?
Well, certainly his economic advisors are telling him that you do have some play inside the economy right now to – you can take some pain. Wilbur Ross was quoted recently saying that, you know, even if there is retaliation on some of these tariffs, that it, you know, could only impact the GDP numbers by as much as 1%. And it sounds like that's a gamble that they're willing to take. And I think they're probably bolstered by the strong jobs numbers and the strong economy at the moment.
I think it is going to be very interesting to see how this complicates talks over NAFTA. These negotiations, they appeared to be very close to being wrapped up. And then Mike Pence, vice president, demands the sunset clause to renegotiate NAFTA after 5 years. Canada's prime minister, Justin Trudeau, says absolutely no way is that going to work out for Canada. So what about NAFTA, Brian?
Well, so Trump wants more concessions out of Canada. He wants better terms for agricultural businesses in the United States when it comes to trading with Canada. And it was actually interesting to hear Prime Minister Trudeau talk about how close he felt that they were to a deal, and now Trump and sent Pence to pull back a little bit and say we want a 5-year sunset on any NAFTA deal. So it is something that Trump has wanted for a long time. He blames like cheap imports from Mexico for a reduction in manufacturing output from the United States, and he's trying to gain leverage by slapping tariffs on them.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to some of the other news of the week, because there was, as usual, so much. And on Fox and Friends this morning, conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza described a phone call that he received from President Trump, who pardoned him yesterday. Dinesh D'Souza had pled guilty to making improper campaign donations, but here's what he said about the call he got.
He said that, "I got to tell you, man to man, you've been screwed." He goes, "I've been looking at the case. I knew from the beginning that it was fishy." But he said upon reviewing it, he felt a great injustice had been done. And he said he just wanted me to be out there to be a bigger voice than ever, defending the principles that I believe in.
Look, Dinesh D'Souza, as we said, he pled guilty to funneling some campaign funds to a candidate. He's also a well-known conspiracy theorist. He has tweeted despicable things in the past about President Obama, for instance, and his Kenyan father. What's behind this particular pardon?
I think what's really interesting, Robin, is the pattern of pardons that we're seeing here. Think about the language that Dinesh D'Souza spoke about that the president used. You know, he's saying, you know, Dinesh D'Souza has been treated very unfairly. He said that about a host of people here. And I think that's got a lot of people thinking, you know, is this about pardoning these specific individuals that the president has either pardoned or mused about pardoning? Or is this about sending a broader signal to the people that are wrapped up in the Russia probe that are close to him? That's something that former Attorney General Eric Holder said today that he believes is the backstory behind this. I think the language is possibly here, though, more telling than the actual actions and the people he selected.
Well, and again, just to, because I, you know, he said he has tweeted despicable things, just to give an example, after the massacre at Marjory Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, 17 died, including so many students. He tweeted out, "Worst news since their parents told them to get summer jobs." That's one of the few tweets that he apologized for. But, you know, is this about him, or is it about, you know, sending the signal that maybe other Trump people that Trump supports down the road, names that we can think of who are being investigated right now, Michael Cohen comes to mind, will be pardoned?
I definitely think the audience for this was Michael Cohen, was Paul Manafort, potentially Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor who's under investigation. And to say, hey guys, you know, I do have this pardon power, and keep the face.
And that's exactly what the right says. Like, remember, the president has the right to pardon whomever he wants to, Juana.
And past presidents have.
And that's exactly right. And I would not disagree with that assertion. But I do think that given the optics of all of this and given the way that the president's talking about this, he's saying this is someone in Dinesh D'Souza's example, for example, who has pled guilty to breaking the law. And the president has said that there is a legal system out there that did not treat him fairly. And as such, he should be pardoned. And I think that as we see kind of this legal quagmire around what's going to happen and this uncertainty with the Russia investigation, he's sending a signal that when the law treats people unfairly, he will bring them out of that. He will pardon them. And I think it'll be very interesting to see just how far he chooses to use that power of the presidency, whether it's to Martha Stewart or someone like a Michael Cohen, for example.
Okay, let's talk about North Korea, because there was a development today in the potential summit. A top lieutenant of Kim Jong-un's hand-delivering a letter to the White House, and it appears as though both sides are now trying to get this meeting off the ground later this month. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday.
"The proposed summit offers a historic opening for President Trump and Chairman Kim to boldly lead the United States and the DPRK into a new era of peace, prosperity, and security. Our two countries face a pivotal moment in our relationship in which it could be nothing short of tragic to let this opportunity go to waste."
Brian, where are we on this and the prospects of this summit happening and the chances for its success?
Well, I mean, it was just 2 weeks ago that the North Koreans stood up a White House delegation in Singapore who had gone there to talk about setting up the talks. And there had been radio silence between North Koreans whenever the White House reached out to them. And now Trump is, by threatening to pull out of the – by canceling the summit, has gotten the North Koreans' attention. And it seems like they are, you know, negotiating what the terms will be. Pompeo feels like the North Koreans are negotiating in good faith at the moment. And every engine that needs to be turning in the White House for the summit to happen is currently turning. We'll have to see what happens over the next several days.
Look, we only have a minute and a half left, but I want to take this one. It's been quite a vulgar week. And this morning, President Trump weighed in on TBS comedy host Samantha Bee, who has apologized but hasn't been fired for calling his daughter a vulgar, misogynistic term. Trump tweeted out, "Why aren't they firing no talent Samantha Bee for the horrible language used on her liberating show? A total double standard." Earlier this week, though, Trump didn't condemn fired TV star Roseanne Barr for her racist language, but she was fired. In the minute that we have, is there a double standard here? It's just so odd that both these things happened in one week, Juana.
It has indeed been quite a vulgar week, and I want to just point out that TBS, which is owned by CNN's parent company, has also come out with an apology here. The thing I want to point out, though, is I think because these things happened in such close proximity to one another, there's been a tendency in these discussions to equivocate the two. And I think that what Samantha Bee said was inappropriate and hateful, but what Roseanne Barr said about Valerie Jarrett, former advisor to President Obama, was racist and fell back on old racist tropes dehumanizing an African-American woman. And I think that we have to be really careful not to equivocate the truth, because the language, quite frankly, was just not the same. The remarks are not equal.
Yeah. Any way you look at it, it's gotten pretty coarse around here. Juana Summers, senior writer at CNN Politics. Brian Bennett, senior White House correspondent for Time magazine. Thank you both.
Good to be with you.
The deadliest animal in America right now isn't a grizzly bear, a mountain lion, or even a western diamondback rattlesnake. It's a deer. More than 200 people are killed every year on the roads, hitting or swerving to avoid hitting deer and other animals. Around 30,000, mostly deer and animals, are injured. Maggie Mullen from Wyoming Public Radio reports on a group of scientists trying to reduce those numbers.
Hitting a deer with your car is always on your mind if you live in Wyoming. I've done it. It was dusk, the worst time of day for these types of collisions. I was lucky, though. I barely touched the deer, and my left headlight was the only casualty. John Oman says he's hit all kinds of animals, like this time.
A coyote just darted out of a small clearing in the forest.
Oman is with State Farm Insurance.
And so there was really no time to, stop or do anything preventative. It was just reactionary at that point, and of course, rather than swerve, I just ended up hitting it.
That coyote didn't survive, and Oman's car didn't do so well either. Oman says the average auto repair claim for these types of wildlife encounters in Wyoming is a little more than $5,000. And Oman says hitting a 300-pound deer or a 1,600-pound moose is just part of the problem.
Sometimes we end up seeing a bigger safety issue by folks being almost prideful about not hitting that deer, that elk, or that moose. And then, of course, they go off the road, or they roll their vehicle, or hit into an icy patch or something.
Wildlife collisions are so common in Montana that the legislature passed a roadkill law that says if you hit an animal, you can get a permit to take it home and eat it. I met Corinna Reginos along Wyoming's Highway 131. She's a conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy who studies how to make roads safer for both humans and animals. She says we know the best way to do it.
The gold standard is underpasses or overpasses or both, with plenty of fencing on either side so that the animals have to go and cross the road at those under and overpasses. And those are 80 to 90% effective consistently throughout the world.
But they're also expensive and not always possible. Flat prairie is easy enough, but that's not the case on a winding highway along a steep mountain range. That's when Plan B comes into play. Wildlife reflectors. You've probably driven by one and not noticed it. It's basically a series of poles on the side of the road,
which are intended to flash when headlights hit them and warn deer that the car is coming and make the deer stop and be more cautious about crossing the road.
But here's the thing. There have been a lot of studies on these reflectors, and
the results are really mixed and not very impressive.
So Reginos led a team of scientists to develop what they hoped would be the definitive study on whether reflectors actually work. And here's where things got interesting. Reginos and her team covered up some of the reflectors and left the others uncovered. The idea was to see if the reflectors really made a difference.
So we covered them with this cheap and easily available and durable material, which just happened to be white canvas bags.
Then Regino says they used thermal video footage to look at how the deer were behaving, and to their surprise, the bag-covered reflectors turned out to be more effective than the reflectors themselves.
And we could actually see that the white bags situation, the deer were more likely to stop and wait for cars to pass before crossing the road, rather than just like running headlong into the road.
Regino says the reflection of headlights on the bags might have simply startled the deer and alerted them to the cars.
It's also possible that that looked to them like their rump patch. A lot of times deer, you know, raise their tail and they show a white rump as a warning sign of a predator or other danger.
Regino says there is still work to be done.
I would love to find some partners to take it forward and develop like a true technology that does better than the white canvas bags and test it thoroughly and see if we can come up with something lasting and effective.
For now, Regino's has some advice for drivers. Take it slow where wildlife may be crossing and keep your eyes on the road. For Here Now, I'm Maggie Mullen.
And Maggie's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. Well, now to Hollywood, where there was a big award show last night. Best drama, best comedy, best animation. I'm talking, of course, about the 19th annual Golden Trailer Awards, honoring those mini films that break down movies into the equivalent of tweets, sometimes the best part of an evening at the movies, although why are trailers so loud? Last night, Black Panther took home the top trailer honor, Best of Show.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be.
Monica Brady is co-founder and executive producer of the Golden Trailer Awards. Monica, this is a whole community in Hollywood. This is considered high craft.
Oh, it is indeed. Trailers are an art form. It's a very difficult job to take a 90-minute to 120-minute movie and cut it down into 2 minutes that sells the public on going to see, you know, their product. It's a high skill.
Right. And it's often the first time you get to see a movie that's coming to the theater soon. So it's your first impression. I love trailers, I have to admit. But talk about the one that won Best of Show. The Black Panther was such a great movie. Is that, you know, part of why the trailer won? Because that bleeds over and people think, oh, that was a great movie and they vote for the trailer? Or what was it about that trailer that made it Best of Show?
I think with that trailer, it crossed so many boundaries of, you know, age and just socioeconomic classes and stuff like that. It was a call to action to go see that movie, and there was like movements of GoFundMes and stuff like that to get large groups of people to go see it. And you want to go experience something as a group, and that's a phenomenon.
Because the trailer was immediately, obviously diverse, as was the movie. Really exciting. Let's listen to a little of Isle of Dogs, the trailer that won for Best Animation / Family.
The Japanese archipelago, 20 years in the future. Canine saturation has reached epidemic proportions. An outbreak of dog flu rips through the city of Megasaki. Mayor Kobayashi issues emergency orders, calling for a hasty quarantine. Trash Island becomes an exile colony. The Isle of Dogs.
Monica Brady, I remember this. I remember thinking, I gotta see this. As you're watching, a young boy arrives on the Isle of Dogs. He's looking for his lost dog. We see him searching. He gets some fights. There are bad guys. He's in the hospital. There's some kind of bomb. It really pulls you in. But also, it has an arc. Is that part of what a good trailer is? You feel like you've seen the movie.
Well, a part of a great trailer is that you get a little bit of a beginning, a little bit of a middle, but no end, because the end is to go see the movie itself. So that's a great trailer because it leaves you wanting more.
By the way, what made you start this?
Well, it's actually a funny story. Is when I graduated from NYU, I optioned the rights to a book called Betrayed by F. Scott Fitzgerald by Ron Carlson with my sister Evelyn, and we'd written the screenplay, and we had enough money cobbled together to go shoot a trailer. And we went looking for trailer editors, and they're not credited anywhere at the end of the movie, at the end of the trailer, nowhere. And so these men and women were anonymous. And so my sister said, oh, there must be an award show, so we'll find them that way. So it's 1999, and we went looking, and there wasn't an award show. And so Evelyn's like, well, let's start one. Mm-hmm. And voila, the Golden Trailers were born.
And the rest is cinematic
history. The rest
is
history.
Yes. Well, let's listen to another of the winners. The Shape of Water won for Best Drama. And again, this is the trailer. It also, of course, won Best Picture Oscar, but this is the first time in the trailer that many of us saw this idea of a woman who couldn't speak, who falls in love with some sort of creature. I mean, the first time you saw this trailer, the creature's being researched in a science lab. She's cleaning there. She's a cleaning woman. Let's listen.
This may very well be the most sensitive asset ever to be housed in this facility.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on two legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
This creature is intelligent, capable of language, of understanding emotions.
The plot thickens. Monica, what was it about this trailer that you think made it the winning one?
Well, it's so great on to listen to it is the background music is so lyrical and matched with those images. It draws you in and makes you want to see more of that. It's the music in that one is very well crafted and very well chosen to draw you into her story and to feel empathy for the creature that looks different from us, from humans.
We know you also have the Golden Fleece Award. What's that?
Oh, that is a crowd favorite. It's when the studio or, you know, the film company has a film that they have to get, you know, seen. That's their job. They're marketers. And they've taken a not-so-great movie and made a fantastic trailer.
Let's listen. This year's winner was the trailer for the film The Meg. The trailer itself is called Carnage. Let's listen a little.
How big is that thing?
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
A living fossil.
Thought to have been extinct for over 2 million years. Wrong.
What we're seeing, researchers underwater in some kind of submarine, and they come across this giant shark, the megalodon, the Meg, which was thought to be extinct. Is this, I mean, do people actually accept this award, given that it's for the trailer that was better than the film?
They accept it and they love the award. It's actually everyone's favorite.
So lots of applause. Hey, Monica Brady,
yep.
So you've got this great thing going, your trailer awards. Are you ever going to make your movie?
I am actually looking to shoot Betrayed by F. Scott Fitzgerald in the winter of this year. And I did make a film last year, and it got released on March 20th, called Above All Things. It was an independent feature film. So I did make my movie.
Well, in
19
one,
years later, yay.
I was going to say 19 years. Good for you. Monica Brady, co-founder and executive producer of the Golden Trailer Awards. Look for her trailer for her film that she's making next year. Monica, thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's more political instability in Europe today. Mariano Rajoy is out as Spain's center-right prime minister after losing a no-confidence vote in parliament. The BBC's Guy Hedgeko joins us now from Madrid. And Guy, this is not completely unexpected. The conflict has been building over a corruption scandal within Rajoy's party. What happened?
Well, that's right. I mean, there have been a series of corruption scandals affecting Rajoy's governing party, but the final straw really seems to have been a court sentence last week, which said that Rajoy's popular party was directly linked to a corrupt network of businesses that were getting public contracts in exchange for bribes and commissions. And it was very explicit in that court sentence, and that seemed to trigger this no-confidence motion led by the Socialist Party.
Well, what can you tell us about that? It's very interesting. Rajoy is the first prime minister in modern Spanish history to be defeated in one of these votes. And after that vote, he shook the hand of the man who helped undo him, Pedro Sanchez, the leader of the Socialist Party. Who is he?
Pedro Sanchez, he's been leader of the Socialist Party since 2014. He's had quite a sort of checkered career himself. He was removed by his own party in 2016. There were big divisions in the party, and he was seen as quite a controversial figure for a while. But for the most part, he's seen as a moderate. He's pro-Europe. And in recent years, there has been quite a bit of bitterness between these two men, because Pedro Sanchez has consistently said that the Rajoy government was plagued by corruption. But now it's up to Mr. Sanchez to try and form a stable government with this new political landscape, which isn't necessarily going to be very easy.
And one of the problems that he'll be facing is this separatist movement in Catalonia, which Rajoy fiercely defended Spain against. I mean, will that shift in power affect the future of that effort?
Well, it's going to be pretty interesting to watch what happens in Catalonia with the Catalan crisis, because Pedro Sanchez, in order to win this confidence motion, he needed the support of Catalan pro-independence parties. So many people believe that he now owes them something. And in Parliament yesterday, he did say that he would reach out to the new Catalan president, Quim Torra, who just took office recently, who's a pro-independence Catalan politician. But Mr. Sanchez said he will speak to Mr. Torra and try and set up some kind of dialogue. So the feeling is that he's going to try and improve relations between Catalonia and Madrid. They've been at a very low ebb over the last few months, and that's going to be a priority, I think, for the new prime minister.
We're also watching Italy this week, where there's been political turmoil there that started over the formation of a government that's skeptical of the EU. So you've got both of these crises happening at just about the same time. Do Italy and Spain together tell us anything more broadly about the direction of European politics?
They do have a lot of similarities. However, there is one important difference, and that is that in Spain, there is no sort of populist movement which is opposed to the European project. Those kind of movements don't exist in Spain, whereas they do exist in places like Italy and UK and so on. Certainly, the new government is very much in favor of the European project. It's not seen as a populist government, and it's going to look for stability, although that might be quite a difficult challenge for it.
That's the BBC's Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Guy, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure.
When you were a child, did you ever see someone get killed? That's a question researchers asked in a study, and the results were pretty stunning. They spoke to 122 men and women who'd been released from prison in Massachusetts between 2012 and 14, and they found that 42% of them had seen someone killed when they were growing up. Bruce Western is one of the researchers. He's co-director of the Columbia University Justice Lab and professor of criminal justice and sociology at Harvard. And Professor Western, when you saw that number, almost half of people you interviewed who were leaving prison had seen someone killed when they were a child. What were your thoughts?
Oh, it was really striking, Robin. I think it was a measure of the exposure to trauma and violence in the lives of people that go to prison. It tells us that people who go to prison have often lived with violence around them for a lifetime in different ways.
And talk more about what might happen to someone who, as a child, witnessed a killing. Just the impacts. You talk about depression, unemployment. Even kids who maybe they didn't even personally witness a death might do less well on tests right after there's a death in, a crime in their neighborhood?
Yeah. Growing up in violent environments has all sorts of negative effects on child development. There's a finding that in the week of a homicide in your neighbourhood, if kids are doing a test that week, they'll tend to test worse. We found in our data, in adulthood, people who had a serious exposure to violence in childhood really struggled with physical and mental health problems.
And you were saying, and I'm sure many are saying, gee, I've never seen anyone killed and I don't expect to. Mm. But so common for people in prison. So what else do you take from that?
So we heard a lot about violence in people's lives. We spoke to our study respondents over a period of a year, so we got to know them quite well. And this one data point of witnessing a killing, this is just one measure of all the different trauma in people's lives.
All put together, you call it human frailty, this idea that people arrive at the point where they might go to prison with problems that accumulate from having lived in poverty?
Not just poverty. The conditions of poverty also created often a very chaotic home life. People were growing up in high crime neighborhoods. And so they're contending with a whole variety of social problems. And this cluster of disadvantages and adversities we called human frailty.
And what did people tell you when you asked them? It's a startling question. And why did you ask them in the first place? Did you see someone killed as a child?
When I began the research, this was not on my radar at all. And we conceived of the study largely as a poverty study. And we wanted to know how people were finding employment, how they were going with their housing, their healthcare, and so on after incarceration. But as we got to know people, they opened up to us. Round about the six-month interview, we thought, man, we're hearing about so much trauma in the lives of our respondents. We need to be asking about this in a systematic way. And so we developed a new module that tried to measure all the different kinds of trauma and adversity people might have encountered in childhood.
And how did they respond to the question, did you see anyone killed?
People were already talking to us about a range of sensitive topics. And sometimes they would say, many times I saw that as a kid. And I have to say, they weren't all homicides. They had witnessed also accidents and suicides as well as homicides.
And you say many more than once. So the 42%, it's actually...
That's an underestimate of the exposure to violence, yeah.
Well, but... other people in poverty have witnessed deaths and not gone down a path of, that's brought them to prison. So how do you connect the fact that somebody might have seen somebody killed or many people killed or die when they were children with the fact that they then are in prison?
It's a good and difficult question. And I wouldn't want to draw a causal connection between that exposure to trauma and ultimately going to prison in adulthood. I think one thing it tells us is that when people come out of prison, they have a lot of trauma in many cases that is largely unaddressed by the kinds of resources and supports that are available to them. And you're absolutely right. People in poor communities face all sorts of adversity, and not everyone goes to prison. There's certainly a strong relationship, I think, between exposure to violence and trauma in childhood and incarceration. But the relationship's not airtight.
Well, and what do you think we should do with the information, specifically the information about, somebody having seen a murder or a death or a suicide as a child? Should there be some sort of system, some algorithm that factors into sentencing?
I think there are two implications. One is, in our sentencing system, we divide the world between victims and offenders, and we draw a bright line there. And everyone we spoke to had some sort of exposure to violence in their lives. And so understanding that victims and offenders are often one and the same person, I think, should lead us to leniency and mercy in our sentencing scheme. There's a lot more moral complexity out there than our criminal justice system allows. The other implication is that for our reentry policy, I think we need to make available resources for mental health care of people who have been exposed to trauma.
Well, you know, there are people who might wince at that notion of mercy for somebody who's become an offender, even if they'd had a troubled childhood. But you point out that the criminal justice system does it all the time.
Yes, indeed. Our affluent middle-class kids also get in trouble, also use drugs, destroy property, get in fights and come into conflict with the law, just as poor kids do. But we have an entire system of supports for our middle-class kids that represent a very significant alternative to the criminal justice system. And often, the justice system, when it does come into play, looks to the future, looks to the potential of that middle-class kid and shows mercy and leniency. And I think if we took a similar view to poor kids of their potential, of all of their human capacities, that's a way of finding more leniency in the system and ultimately, I think, a way out of the problem of mass incarceration.
Well, as you say, look at their past. When you have a kid who's on his way to college who might have messed up, the lawyer will say, yeah, but, you know, Your Honor, he was going to go to college. He's got this bright future. It sounds like you're saying with someone who had the kind of past you've described and has witnessed maybe many killings, ask that that be taken into consideration.
Yes, yeah. And the criminal justice system struggles with this a lot. The system has to be one of accountability and has to accord people their moral agency. And I think taking account of one's past allows us to treat that moral agency with a level of compassion. And I think that's really the main implication of a finding like this.
Yeah, but you know, you can, just one further question, you can keep people maybe out of prison because of this past and because of this human frailty that they've developed, because of all the violence they've been victim of or witnessed. But until there's something to help them not to be on that path, they'll just, you know, once you've kept them out of prison, doesn't there have to be something to change that path?
Yes. I think if we're thinking about how should we respond to the problem of violence in very disadvantaged communities, punishment offers only a very limited kind of response. Ultimately, I think we find justice in the abatement of social contexts, which themselves are very violent.
Professor Bruce Western, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Robin.
He is professor of criminal justice and sociology at Harvard. His new book about the Boston Reentry Study, which found almost half of those leaving prison had witnessed death as a child, is called Homeward: Life in the Year After Prison.
No way you'd ever score on him on that goal. Keep your stick out of the way. That's the last time I'm saying it.
The real deal.
That's hockey analyst Don Cherry in a broadcast of a recent Stanley Cup playoff game. For more than three decades, Cherry has been a fixture on the TV show Hockey Night in Canada. And before that, he was a coach who won Coach of the Year honors in both the NHL and its developmental league, the AHL. But there's always been a knock on Cherry that he never coached a team to a championship. At least that is what most people think. Martin Kessler from NPR's Only a Game explains.
Back in the 60s, hockey players didn't wear helmets. The rinks were lined with chicken wire, not glass. But even in that Rock'em Sock'em era, there was one player who stood out for his toughness, veteran defenseman Don Cherry. Here's Pittsford, New York natives John Hoff and Jay Hill.
He was tough as nails. Really tough guy.
I can remember when they were up in Quebec playing the Quebec Aces, and the lead story in the 11 o'clock news was Don Cherry got in a fight with a guy, and it lasted like 40 minutes. They kept coming out of the penalty box. They couldn't break it up.
John and Jay grew up rooting for Don Cherry in the American Hockey League's Rochester Americans. But in 1969, around the time the boys were getting ready to enter Pittsford High School, Cherry retired from hockey.
I worked 2 years on construction, and I was laid off. And I actually, for about 2 months, I couldn't get a job. I played 16 years pro, and then to not to be able to have a job, it was very humiliating.
It was during that down period in Don Cherry's life when a man connected to Pittsford High School approached him.
And he said, how about Don, you coaching? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, you got nothing else to do.
Soon enough, John and Jay learned that Don Cherry, the toughest man in town, the man they'd grown up cheering for, would be their new hockey coach. Here's teammate Al Viverberg.
Our very first practice ever. We were on the ice waiting for Don, and he stepped on the ice with his skate guards on and went down like a ton of bricks. We didn't know if he should laugh, what should we do, but as I recall, we kind of said, well, he's a regular guy.
Cherry would get to practice an hour early to tell the boys hockey stories as they laced up their skates. He wanted to show them that he cared, but he wasn't perfect.
He struggled with names. My name's Jay, but I was always Jack. For 3 years, I was Jack. He couldn't pronounce...
My last name, Viverberg. I was Viberg.
So I don't ever remember him yelling at us. We just wanted to play so hard for him that he never got... You know, coaches get frustrated and all that stuff. But we tried our hardest from day one till the end.
In just Cherry's second season as coach, Pittsford reached the league championship. The success helped Cherry land back with the Rochester Americans as player coach. But Cherry didn't want to give up his job coaching the boys. So for the 1971-72 season, he shuttled back and forth from coaching the pros to coaching Pittsford. Former player Jeff Knisley.
If you asked him today, I'd guarantee he could name our power play from 1972.
On the points was Al Viverberg, John Hoff. There were two guys that did screamers from the point. We had a big centerman named Jay Hill. We had a guy, Eddie Scott, that used to work in the corners, and Jeff Knisley was the playmaker.
It's Knisley, but close enough. Pittsford finished the regular season with an undefeated record and once again reached the championship. But there was a problem. On the day of the big game, Cherry was scheduled to fly out with his pro team, the Americans. There was a chance he'd have to leave before the high school game was over. Pittsford jumped out to a lead, but the clock wasn't on Cherry's side. In the middle of the third period, he had to leave the Pittsford bench.
Kind of inch up the stairs. He didn't really want to leave.
I can still see him at the top of the rink. He was holding planes up and everything.
Yeah.
And we scored a goal to cement it.
And I think he was like, okay, it's in hand.
Yeah, I went right to the last minute. I said, Don, if you don't leave now, you're going to miss the plane. So I had to leave them.
Pittsford hung on for the championship and an undefeated season.
What did it feel like to have to celebrate the championship, though, without him there?
He was with us.
Just 2 years after coaching Pittsford to the championship, Don Cherry got the call to coach the Boston Bruins, which he did for 5 seasons, but no championship. Years after Cherry's NHL coaching career was over, Jeff Knisley went to visit him at one of his restaurants in Toronto.
The bar was full, and he came running out, put his hands up in the air, and he goes, people, one of my players is here. It's the first time I ever signed autographs. They all thought I played for them in professional hockey, and it was our high school team.
The guys from Pittsford know that, to the average hockey fan, they're not as important as Cherry's former NHL players, even if they were the ones to deliver him his only championship. But hearing all the Pittsford boys' stories left me with one last question for Don Cherry.
I wonder if you view them differently from your former NHL players that you coached.
Oh, no, I don't. I think of them very fondly. I think, actually, I'm more closer to them than my pros. Because, let's face it, they were the guys that made me.
For Here and Now, I'm Martin Kessler.
And, Robin, we're talking about hockey. I don't know if you're watching the Stanley Cup Final, but Game 3 tomorrow night, yeah, in Washington, D.C., it's the Capitals. versus the Vegas Golden Knights. It's the Knights' first season in the NHL, and they're playing it for the Stanley Cup in Las Vegas, for goodness sake. I never thought I would see the day. Best of seven series, tied at one.
This is a terrific series. And by the way, speaking of Don Cherry, I've heard stories, but what happens at Boston Garden stays at Boston Garden.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. In association with the BBC World Service, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.